A judge's ruling against formerly incarcerated people in the battleground state of Florida could make the literal cost of voting prohibitive.
Florida in the 90s created this elaborate system of fines and fees to subsidize the court system. And frankly, most people can't ever afford to pay these costs off.
I'm Tanzina Vega, and today on The Takeaway for Tuesday, September 15th, we're talking about what this means for 800,000 people trying to figure out if they can vote in the Sunshine State come November. Plus, speaking of battlegrounds, we head to Wisconsin to check in on how President Trump's, quote, law and order campaign is doing with voters. And communities of color have been disproportionately affected by COVID-19, but recruiting them for vaccine trials has been a challenge.
We need to feel that the patients on those trials are reflective of the patients that we're going to give the vaccines to.
Let's get started. At the beginning of September, President Trump made a stop in Kenosha, Wisconsin, following the police shooting of Jacob Blake and subsequent protest. There, his message was clear. In a bid to win over conservative voters in the state, he touted law and order and accused liberal politicians of appeasing and encouraging, quote, violent mobs. But Wisconsin is a key battleground state in the upcoming election, and it's one that President Trump barely carried to victory in 2016. And a recent poll conducted by the New York Times and Siena College shows that the president's message is not resonating with Wisconsin voters as much as he may have expected. In fact, about 1 in 5 voters in the state said that while protests like the one in Kenosha were more concerning than rooting out racism in the criminal justice system, they are still planning to vote for Joe Biden. That same poll also found that Joe Biden is leading President Trump 48% to 43% in Wisconsin overall. So we're going to talk about it. I've got Reed Epstein, politics reporter from the New York Times, and James Causey, project reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, and a 2019-2020 Marquette University O'Brien Fellow. Reed and James, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having me.
Great to talk to you.
I'm glad we were able to get both of you on the line. Reed, let's start with you. This new poll from the Times and Siena College was somewhat surprising, I think, to a lot of folks. Were you all surprised at the Times when you saw the data?
Well, we weren't necessarily surprised that Joe Biden is leading in Wisconsin. He's been leading over President Trump throughout the spring and the summer. What was surprising was the extent to which the law and order message from the president has seeped in with voters, but yet it isn't necessarily accruing to President Trump's benefit. More voters believe that Joe Biden would defund the police than say he wouldn't, even though he has repeated over and over again that he would not. That's been a key message from President Trump since a lot of this unrest began back in June. And just as many voters think that rioting in cities is a bigger problem than racism in the criminal justice system, even though, like you said, about 1 in 5 of those voters still are backing Joe Biden for president.
James, you are on the ground in the state. You're seeing all of this play out. When you saw this poll, what was your interpretation of the poll? Was it surprising to you to hear this, or was this pretty much in line with what your reporting has shown so far?
No, like Reed said, it's pretty much in line with what we expected. There really were no surprises. You know, one thing that is surprising is this law and order message that's coming across loud and clear. I think is strong with certain voters, but with other voters, people of color, I don't think that message is coming across in a way that the president would like it to. Jacob Blake, though, the shooting of Jacob Blake sort of changed the game, so to speak. When people saw this man walking to his car and shot in the back 7 times. I mean, you could talk about law and order all you want, but, you know, what it really comes down to is, you know, you have a white cop shooting what appeared to be an unarmed black man in the back 7 times. And that's what a lot of people see. And that's, you know, part of the reason for the Black Lives Matter movement.
Reed, the president, as we mentioned at the top, did go to Kenosha, Wisconsin at the beginning of September and really made a very profound outreach effort to the law enforcement in Kenosha, not so much with the Blake family. Do you think that that may have affected the results of this poll here?
One thing that we've seen from President Trump and essentially most of his administration is a core focus on trying to bring back into the Republican fold voters who voted for him in 2016, but have since been repelled by the conduct, his personal conduct and the actions of his administration. His path to victory in states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania is to bring some of those wayward Republicans back into the fold. It's not about winning over people of color or really even many independent voters. It's keeping suburban Republicans who have left the party because of Trump and to convincing them that Joe Biden is an unacceptable choice. And so that's why we have seen sort of the repeated efforts to brand Joe Biden and Democrats as extreme leftists, saying that they would defund the police. We've heard some of this rhetoric about the suburbs from President Trump. It's really about scaring people away from voting for Joe Biden. And the polling to date has shown that it's not particularly working. And it is, by all means, energizing voters on the left. One thing that we saw in our poll was that voters in cities in Wisconsin, which for most voters, that means Milwaukee and Madison, are far more likely to say that they're certain to vote in this November's election than voters in rural and suburban areas. And so while what Trump is doing may have, in fact, the opposite effect of what he intends.
One of the other things that the poll looked at, Reid, is who, not just who's supporting who, but also how voters are looking at how President Trump handled the pandemic. What did you find there?
Well, this is not a big surprise either, and this has been similar polling data we've seen for months, is that Trump does not get very high marks on the pandemic. He still scores well than Joe Biden on the economy. It's really the last significant policy area that he does. But voters think that President Trump has done a poor job handling the pandemic, just as for the most part, they think he's done a poor job handling some of the unrest in race relations in this country.
James, how is the coronavirus pandemic right now playing out in Wisconsin from your reporting?
Well, over the last couple of days, we've seen record numbers of cases and record numbers of new cases and record numbers of positive cases in this, where, you know, more being tested, but the positive numbers from that are in the 20% range. And that's the highest that it's been since the pandemic started. And that's very scary. You know, when you want to talk about, you know, the last time we voted here in the state, you know, you had, you know, this was during a pandemic when a lot of people tried to get it postponed. We had thousands and thousands of people crowding into five polling places, high schools in the city during the pandemic. And I think a lot of those people who voted, you know, they put their lives in danger during the pandemic. And some of those people who tried to vote were rained on. They got out of line. And those people are still upset. And we're going to see a lot of those people come out in droves to vote this time. And I think that's why the reporting is showing that more people in the city are planning to vote, because they're still upset over what happened last time.
One thing that has stood out this time around is this multiracial coalition of people who have been protesting regularly to bring change to criminal justice. Many of them are younger. Many of them are even white. Are you, James, seeing that same coalition of folks are now going to take that energy to the polls in November?
Well, you know, the hope is that they do turn this into the vote, because just protesting and not using your right to vote would not do much. What we're seeing is that, you know, over 100 days of protesting, this is a very diverse crowd of people protesting. You have Black, white, the LGBTQ community out there as well. And they want their voices to be heard. And one thing that we're hearing and seeing is that they're telling these young people to go vote. And so that's very exciting, because people are understanding that they do have to exercise that right to vote. But I do have to say this, you know, this is a young coalition of people, and it's still hard for a lot of young people to get excited about voting for two old white men in their late 70s. I mean, this will probably be the last time, or it should be the last time, that we have a man that's going to be 78 years old and another one that's like, I think, 76 or 77 running for president. It's very hard to get young people excited to vote for old white men that age. It just is. And that's going to have to change.
Reed, to James's point, I mean, we're talking about younger voters who were out, or younger Wisconsinites who were out protesting. But Wisconsin is a very white state, and its voters are also relatively older compared to other states. Does the poll tell you anything about how older voters in Wisconsin are feeling?
One thing that's striking in this poll of Wisconsin that has been consistent across polls of other battleground states is that President Trump has lost his advantage with older voters. The poll showed that among Wisconsin voters 65 and older, that Joe Biden had a 9-point lead. President Trump won that demographic by more than 10 points in 2016. The same is the case. There's been polling in Pennsylvania that shows a 20-point swing among voters 65 and older, a 16-point swing in Florida among voters 65 and older. If President Trump shows that amount of atrophy among older voters, he cannot win the election. And so that's another reason you see
he cannot win the election nationally, not just take Wisconsin, you mean, Reed?
He cannot win the election. If he loses 20 points of support from voters 65 and older, he cannot win these battleground states. He doesn't have enough support among younger voters to make that up.
To that point, James, are you seeing an increased effort to get people to go to the polls in November?
Yes, we're seeing it. Every single time that they have a huge march or something like that, we see people out there telling people that they have to register to vote. We're seeing a real strong push for absentee voting, which is, my mailbox is flooded, you know, every other day with saying it's time to, you know, get your absentee vote in. You know, it's not too late to, you know, apply for your absentee vote and all those kind of things. So, there's been a strong push, advertising as well, you know, emails telling people to vote. The NAACP here is pushing for early voting. So, yeah, that's definitely happening, and it's happening among young people.
We're relatively close to the election. It's hard to forecast, but given everything that we just talked about, do we expect these numbers that the poll has shown so far to hold?
All of us are out of the prediction business after 2016.
I know.
But the one key thing to remember is that in a lot of these battleground states, in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, President Trump did not get to 50% in those places. But because there were multiple third-party candidates siphoning votes away, he was able to carry the state. And there's a belief sort of in both parties, in both campaigns, that if it is just a one-on-one battle or a one-on-one contest with a Libertarian candidate, that would accrue to Joe Biden's benefit because there aren't left-wing candidates there to take votes that would otherwise have gone to Joe Biden. There's certainly some polling data that is head-scratching. President Trump is doing much better among Hispanic voters than I think people had anticipated, and that younger voters are not as strong for Joe Biden as certainly Democrats would hope, or as the Biden campaign had hoped. But frankly, older voters vote more in much greater frequency than younger voters. And so if Joe Biden is able to swing the percentage of older voters by, you know, 15 to 20 points, as the polls are indicating, that's much more than he would lose from a soft turnout from younger voters.
Reed Epstein, politics reporter from The New York Times, and James Causey, project reporter and columnist at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thanks. No problem. Anytime.
And finally, all voting members of the Academy have nominated the following films for Best Picture.
Last week, the Oscars announced a new set of standards that Best Picture nominees will need to meet starting in 2024. Films will be required to satisfy 2 out of 4 categories, which include on-screen representation, creative leadership, industry opportunities, and audience development. And the overall goal is clear: to make the Oscars less white. But the new rules aren't exactly a game changer. Recent Best Picture nominees with mainly white casts, including The Irishman and La La Land, would still have no problem making the cut. For more, I'm joined by April Rain, the creator of #OscarsSoWhite. April, great to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Fanshan Cox, head of strategic outreach for Pearl Street Films and one of the co-founders of Hollywood's Inclusion Writer. Fanshan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. I have to say that I am such a huge fan of both of your work. Tanzina, your intersectional lens has brought me back to NPR in April, of course. You know, you're my daily inspiration to keep pushing. So I'm so glad to be here.
Fanshan, I can just have you on the show every day and we can repeat that.
Sounds good.
I'm taken aback and I'm very grateful. Thank you so much for those words. We really appreciate them. Well, let's start with that, Fanshan. I mean, what were your thoughts on what just happened with this new rules from the Academy?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exciting. I think every time there's a new tool that we can utilize to change Hollywood is a good thing. I think then you dig in and do the work of critique and you know, kind of making sure that it really is following the path to change. I know we've learned that about the Inclusion Writer over the last couple years, but I'm excited for it. I think it addresses a lot of the things that we're looking to do with the Inclusion Writer, and for that I'm really grateful.
April, you are the pioneer behind Oscar So White, the hashtag that resonated around the world just a couple of years ago. When you see these new rules coming out of the Academy, will this mean the Oscars will be not so white?
I don't think so. I think okay. I'm a little glass less full than Fanshan is, but she always has such a wonderful spirit, so I take inspiration from that. You know, as you mentioned in the intro, there are so many films, you know, I think, what is it, the Annenberg study said that nearly 90% of the films from 2019 would have qualified, and so if you can qualify for these new diversity and inclusion standards without making any changes at all, especially when we look at films like Green Book, for example, which was widely criticized for its portrayal of traditionally underrepresented communities. If you can still make the rubric under the Academy's new standards without making any changes, then it clearly doesn't go far enough.
Yeah, April, one of the things that when we talk about things like affirmative action, for example, and putting these rules in place, often the beneficiaries of these rules are white women, as opposed to people of color. Are these new Oscar rules really going to increase the percentages of people of color specifically?
It remains to be seen, but I truly am not hopeful. I mean, let's remember in 2016, year two of Oscar So White, when yet again for two consecutive years, the no people of color were nominated for any of the acting categories. The Academy committed to doubling the number of people of color and doubling the number of women within its ranks by this year, by 2020. And they made this breathless announcement about how they had actually hit their numbers, which is great, right? Because we want more marginalized communities within the Academy. But again, when you peel back the layers, you see that there is very little change. So from 2016 to 2020, the Academy went from 92% white to 81% white. It went from 75% male to 67% male. Now, is that progress? Mm-hmm. Yes, but it still means that the Academy is overwhelmingly white and male. In addition, yeah. The Academy still does not require its membership to view the films or performances before they vote. So that means it's not a meritocracy as we would like to believe. It truly is something closer to a popularity contest amongst older white men.
Fanshan, your work has been largely on inclusion and equity writers. For those of us who are not traveling in Hollywood circles regularly, what does that mean?
It means that an A-lister, such as Matt Damon or Ben Affleck, who I work with, would include a clause in their contracts as they're negotiating, let's say, with a studio for the next role. And, you know, some people have very frivolous clauses like I spoke to someone, and this isn't frivolous, who said that she wants cruelty-free makeup in her trailer, right? And that was easy for her to implement, and that was part of her clause. Our clause says that we want the cast and crew to represent what the world actually looks like. So that's what the Inclusion Writer is. That's the purpose for it. And I just want to say I 100% agree with April that this is a tiny, tiny change in the sense of I, you know, hoping that people will self-reflect as they choose who they're going to hire. But in reality, what we have to know is that all of these changes are only happening because of people like April, because of Black Twitter, because of those of us who are standing up and saying, we're not going to take this anymore. And so what's really happening is that nobody's watching the Academy Awards anymore, and that's why they're making this change. So the way that I see these things, the inclusion rider and, you know, and these new, you know, stipulations by the Academy, is that we can now hold people accountable. And that's what's important to me, is that when you say it publicly like this, when these films get nominated in, you know, in 2024, we can say, listen, you said you were, your purpose was to do this, and it still isn't doing that. And that is if people are still watching it all.
There you go. April, to that point, I mean, one of the things that often happens when we have diversity efforts, if you will, like this, is that the people that are hired to bring in that quote unquote diversity can sometimes be tokenized. I mean, it's something that's happened to me in my career where people will say, well, you're here to fix some, to right some sort of racial wrong or gender wrong. But at the end of the day, how do we avoid tokenizing those people who are brought in under these new rules, for example?
Right. Well, I think the important thing is that we normalize inclusion. We all hate the word normalize, but you know, we need to be more intentional.
There's so many words, but
we need to be more intentional, and we have to get buy-in from the top down, from the people that greenlight the films, from the studio heads. They need to make a commitment to these changes. And then, you know, that information, having support and therefore resources for the rest of the studio to make the changes and decisions that we'd like to see, will be more easily implemented.
Fanchon, are you optimistic that will happen? We've got about 50 seconds left.
The top-down approach is exactly where the change needs to happen. So, you know, currently that is a lot of older white cisgendered men. They probably will have to die out, I'm sorry to say. Well, no, I'm not. I think that ultimately, because they are the ones who really make these decisions about what gets greenlit, that is where the change is going to happen. And the beautiful thing is that we've got incredible young folks in the, you know, that are coming up as emerging storytellers who are going to push for this change.
You know, one question that comes up is about how awards are really just one part of the film industry. And we can talk about this in any industry, right? Journalism has similar issues with diversity and lack thereof. And then we think about who wins the Pulitzer and who doesn't. Is there too much focus on overhauling the Oscars rather than changing the industry more broadly? I'd love to hear both of your thoughts. April.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I always say that, you know, it must begin at the beginning, meaning we need to talk about what's going on with the screenwriter when they open their laptop or pick up a writing utensil. You know, when a screenwriter sits down and says, I'm going to write the next big budget action film, and that my protagonist is going to be, you know, a tall, leggy blonde from the Midwest. Well, that's fine. But by the time, you know, the script is finished and it goes to the agent, the producer and the director, and they're going to casting, the only person anyone is thinking about is Scarlett Johansson or Jennifer Lawrence. And then we have to ask, what does the person's hair color have to do with them being a badass protagonist, right? Nothing. And so we need to change where we are at the very beginning. I've always said that it's about whose story is being told and who is telling the story. So, you know, Hollywood, as you mentioned, is, you know, the Oscars are at the end. You know, it's after the film has been made. And that's why I think these new standards from the Academy are so interesting, because you can qualify by hitting at least two of the four, two of them being regardless of where you are in the production of the film. You can hit it after the fact. So your film can be, you know, as homogenous and generic as, you know, The Irishman or any other film, and yet still qualify for Best Picture.
Fanchon, when we think about, you know, a lot of these writers and, you know, when you're talking about frivolous things, I kept thinking about the joke that I only want, you know, green M&Ms or something, you know, only Avion water, things like that. But these are really serious asks, especially in this moment. Do you often hear pushback from folks who say, I don't really think that's necessary, or, you know, Why do we need to do that?
And that's part of these lessons that we've had to learn in the last couple of years are how to respond to the pushback immediately to shut it down and to keep moving forward. So we get everything from the initial pushback was, that you're forcing us to hire people that don't exist. And so we started to collaborate with people who are creating databases, full of women of color, for example, women of color storytellers like the JTC list. I created a podcast called Sister Brunch, which is highlighting Black women working in entertainment precisely for these reasons is they are out there. You just are not looking for us. So that was our first point. Another piece of pushback we get a lot, and this was really interesting to figure out how to respond to was, we're already going above and beyond that. We don't need to sign that writer because we're so committed to this. And of course, this is that performative statement like we've seen, recently with around the George Floyd protests, because then when the film comes out, it never actually reflects that. But when someone says we're already doing that, how do you respond to that? So of course, our response now is, great, go ahead and sign this as well. Because one of the pieces of the inclusion writer that gets lost often is that we have tied in after the fact analysis. So the film comes out, we go back and we work with Annenberg to examine the numbers, really do an analysis of the numbers. And then that production company or studio pays a fee for the places where they weren't able to meet what they had committed to. And that fee then goes back into emerging storytellers to April's point around starting from that point of the process. And then finally, what we're getting right now is we have to deal with COVID. So we just don't have time to do anything else. Our attorneys mm-hmm. are really busy. So they can't spend the time on looking over this, which is a, three-page template with very easy to meet standards, but they don't have the time. So that's our latest.
April, do you see any potential points of pressure that could be applied to the industry moving forward to increase diversity? Obviously, the public accountability is one thing, but we are, in a pandemic, and that's really shifted the industry and how people are viewing the industry, the dollars that are flowing into, at least from movie theaters and the like. And so the industry itself is sort of in this weird place. But are there potential areas that consumers and entertainment consumers can put pressure on Hollywood if they want to see more change?
Absolutely. And we do that with our dollars, either through streaming services, right? Because most of us are still at home. And so we're not going into movie theaters. Or when we go eventually to the movie theater, we choose what we want to see. And I think that consumers are becoming much more savvy and saying we will choose those things that represent us. And we see that at the box office time and time again with films like Coco and Crazy Rich Asians and obviously Black Panther, $1.4 billion worldwide. And I think that we are in a really interesting place right now with respect to the death of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery right now. I think the entire country, regardless of race and ethnicity, is sort of sitting up and saying, things are kind of bad. let's be more intentional with respect to the choices that we make. And so, we see that brands are shifting and, everybody put their little Black Lives Matter flyer out there. But again, consumers are savvy and saying, okay, that's great for social media, but what kind of money are you putting into these changes? Yeah. We also see people like Michael B. Jordan, who was an early adopter of the inclusion writer, and other producers saying, we're no longer going to wait for a seat at the table in Hollywood. We're going to create our own mansion and put our tables in it. And people are responding positively with respect to those choices and making their determinations about where they're going to spend their hard-earned dollars.
Yeah, I think the pandemic really made it clear to a lot of us how lacking we are. I mean, many of us knew already, but others who kind of have just gotten used to not being able to see ourselves and, you know, watching streaming content or TV or films. And here we are in the pandemic. And I know so many of my friends and myself said, you know, I'm only going to watch things with Black and Brown people in them. And I ran out of content within a couple weeks, right?
Oh my gosh.
So it's also just saying we are refusing to continue to watch content that reflects whiteness as the default for human being. We are not going to watch this anymore. And we have to be both vocal about it, but also not choose to actually not watch it.
And I also want to just point out, you know, I know the inclusion writer, Oscar So White, is not just race-based, right? We're talking about all traditionally underrepresented communities.
Yes.
So that's race and ethnicity. That's disability, whether cognitive or physical, visible or not. That's age. That's sexual orientation. That's gender identity. That's indigenous people. It's all people who have been marginalized in this country. They deserve to have their stories told. And we all will be richer people for having watched and consumed those stories.
Yeah, I have to say, I agree. I mean, I think we have this a similar issue in journalism, and I'm a Latina, you know, from a working class background who's 45 years old. So I feel like, Fanchon, to your earlier point about just the intersectional lens, I think that's often lost a lot in conversations around media as well, and how those layers, you know, really add to our lived experience and what we can offer to audiences.
Yeah. It's interesting that in the kind of the opening statement for the Academy changes, they say that they're making these changes to better reflect the diversity of the movie-going audience. Well, they've left out a huge swath of movie-going audience because we don't see ourselves, right? Mm. So that is exactly the point, is that we all have the right to see ourselves reflected in our media and in our entertainment. And until we do, all of these, you know, kind of minor changes will be minor.
Well, on that note, we will continue to pay attention. Fanchon, April, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Each election season, political memoirs abound, doorstops that sometimes divulge more than intended.
No matter how diligently they present themselves in the most electable light, they always reveal themselves, their insecurities, their fears, their ambitions.
How to read a Politico on this week's On the Media from WNYC. Find On the Media wherever you get your podcasts.
Last week, a federal appeals court issued a decision that could block hundreds of thousands of formerly incarcerated people from voting in Florida. The move was the latest in a series of back-and-forth actions affecting voting rights for people with felony records in the state. At the center of the court's decision was a law that passed last year by Florida's Republican-led state legislature, which required people with felony records to pay off any outstanding fines connected to their cases before they could register to vote. In May, a U.S. district judge deemed this law to be a form of a poll tax and therefore deemed it unconstitutional under the 24th Amendment. Governor Ron DeSantis quickly appealed that decision, and now the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit has overturned the district judge's ruling. Eugene Williams was released from prison in 2011 after serving 18 years in Florida's Department of Corrections, and he now works for the Florida Rights Restoration Coalition. And I talked to him in June after the district judge called the law unconstitutional.
This pay-to-vote situation Mr. DeSantis had going on, it was like he was suppressing us. I am a living witness that people can be rehabilitated. And I think that it would be more purposeful if they would just get on board and start granting us these rights to vote, because it gives us purpose. But I tell people all the time, just remember, no matter what we are disenfranchised, we're still your neighbors. We're the guy that's sitting on the corner, at the corner store, we're still there. So why not offer some incentive to make us more productive in life instead of keeping us oppressed? We're based on second chances.
Joining me now is Lawrence Maurer, a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times and the Miami Herald's Tallahassee Bureau. Lawrence, thanks for being with me.
Thank you for having me on.
So where do voting rights for people with felony records stand after the appeals court decision? Is this now a final decision?
It's unlikely to be a final decision. It's likely that this will be appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which is the next step. But right now, as of right now, people with felony convictions who owe fines, fees, or restitution will not be allowed to vote ahead of the November election.
Lawrence, how did the appeals court vote? I mean, this feels very much like it may have been split down ideological lines. Was that your sense of the decision as well?
Well, it did split down between judges who were appointed by Republicans and judges who were appointed by Democrats, 6-4. And it very much was obviously a partisan divide. The liberal judges said that this is not a case that will go down well in history. And, you know, it's something that this has been a partisan battle for the last 18 months since Amendment 4 passed in Florida and since it went through the legislature. This was something that has been primarily Republican driven.
We should note here that if you can remind our listeners, because this has been so much of a back and forth, Amendment 4 passed with the majority of Floridians supporting this measure, did it not?
Almost two-thirds of Floridians, yes. More Floridians voted for Amendment 4 than voted for either Senator Rick Scott or Governor Ron DeSantis.
So, Lawrence, what does that tell us? I mean, if Floridians themselves voted to allow people with felony records to the right to vote without having to pay fees and fines, is the legislature essentially silencing the will of Floridians generally?
Well, that's the question. You know, Amendment 4 said that people with felony convictions could have their rights restored if they paid off or they satisfied all terms of their sentence. And there's been varying definitions of what all terms means. You know, the backers, the creators of Amendment 4, did say that all terms included all financial costs, all court fees, all court fines, which are usually $10,000 and above punishments often, and restitution to victims. And however, after that passed, I think a lot of people realized that, oh my gosh, all terms might actually include all these financial penalties, which frankly, a lot of Floridians were not familiar with. Most Floridians are familiar with a term of sentence, you know, parole, probation, and incarceration. The fact that these fines and fees might be included in here, I think, came as a surprise to a lot of people who voted for Amendment 4. But as the 11th Circuit said, all terms means all terms.
Prior to the 11th Circuit's decision, this was something a prior judge had called this a poll tax, if you will. How do you explain a poll tax? I mean, isn't that illegal?
Yeah, a poll tax is illegal, as the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled. And the earlier judge's ruling had really said one part of these financial obligations are a poll tax. And that is, he's talking just about the court fees. So in 1998, Floridians passed a constitutional amendment of their own that allowed courts to impose all kinds of fees onto people as a way to shift the cost burden of the court system. For example, you have a $100 public defender fee if you're appointed a public defender. You have a $100 cost of conviction fee if you were prosecuted in a felony case. And these are costs that do directly go to pay for the criminal justice system. Some of these fees go into the state's general revenue fund, which goes to pay for a variety of services. And he said specifically these are a tax in any other name. And what the 11th Circuit said, the majority opinion said, is that, well, yes, these go to pay for government. They cited past Supreme Court rulings saying that if a tax is a penalty, which they're saying that these fees amount to penalties, that they don't count as a tax. They don't count as a poll tax. The dissenting opinion The four judges who were appointed by Democrats said that, no, you know, what the Supreme Court really says is that, you know, what's the primary purpose of these things? If it's the primary purpose is as a, you know, revenue raising source, which clearly this is, the Supreme Court has said that, you know, these are attacks. So it was far from settled, but the issue of whether or not these things amount to attacks has been one of the primary arguments.
Lawrence, which population, who makes up the majority of the people who will be affected by this in terms of race and social class? Are we talking largely about Black and brown Floridians? Are we talking about poor Floridians?
Poor Floridians, absolutely. The overall prison population is more white than any other ethnicity, but it's no secret that Black Floridians are the ones primarily affected by this, because they are the ones who are disproportionately members of the criminal justice system. You know, people who get prosecuted and incarcerated. So they are absolutely hit harder than other groups of people here.
A spokesperson for Governor DeSantis released a statement after the appeals court decision saying, quote, "There are multiple avenues to restore rights, pay off debts, and seek financial forgiveness from one's victims. Second chances and the rule of law are not mutually exclusive." Lawrence, how does what the governor's office say differ from what people with felony records and activists have to say?
Well, in quite a few ways. There's been a question of, okay, you have to pay off all your financial obligations, but, you know, when do the financial obligations end? You know, according to the courts, most people can't afford to pay off these amounts upon release from prison or probation. Okay, so when that happens, these things are usually converted to civil liens that are sent out to debt collectors. And these things can dog people for a long time, for years and years and years, if they're ever paid off. And Senate Bill 7066, which DeSantis himself pushed for, did allow people with felony convictions to go to a judge to get their monies converted to community service hours or to have them waived altogether. But that's not even an adequate solution, because not even the state made that argument seriously in front of the federal judges in this case, as that being an adequate solution. Just because in most counties, there is no such process to go petition a judge to have your amounts converted to community service hours. And even if they were converted to community service hours, you're talking on the order of hundreds and hundreds of hours you would have to spend on community service, hours that people with felony convictions who are trying to find jobs usually don't have time to do. And so it's a completely unrealistic option for most people.
Lawrence, let's talk a little bit about the election that is on the horizon in less than 2 months. We're talking about one of the most significant elections. And of course, Florida, as we know, is a key battleground state. It has been for many elections prior. This decision will essentially leave close to 700,000, 800,000 Floridians disenfranchised from being able to cast their vote. What effect could that have on the Florida vote come November?
Realistically, there wasn't a lot of time. There's the deadline to register for November is October 5th. So there wasn't a lot of time for these people to register anyway. And the whole court case and the back and forth over who's eligible and who's not has absolutely had a chilling effect on those people from registering in the first place. Because if you do register and you do vote and you owe money, you do face a chance of being potentially prosecuted for it. It's probably unlikely, but, you know, that the chance still exists. And the number of people that we're talking about here, like around 800,000 or so, were not a particularly high turnout group of voters anyway. People with felony convictions are typically not high turnout voters.
But given what's been happening in the country, that could have changed this year.
Well, as we know, in Florida, these elections can be really close in the order of, I mean, there were two recounts for the two highest races just in 2018, on the order of, you know, 11,000 to, you know, 70,000 votes or so. That's how close some of these races are. So could it have an effect? Potentially, yes. We don't really know.
Lawrence Maurer is a reporter for the Tampa Bay Times and the Miami Herald's Tallahassee Bureau. Lawrence, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
As the coronavirus death toll in the United States hovers around 200,000, Black, Latino, and Native American populations have made up a disproportionate amount of that total, with Black Americans in particular being more than twice as likely as white Americans to die from COVID-19. But many of the companies that are working to develop a vaccine so far have fallen short when it comes to recruiting people of color to participate in trials. As of late August, people of color only made up about one-fifth of the participants in trials being conducted by two major pharmaceutical companies, Moderna and Pfizer. Some of the challenges in recruitment are connected to the legacy of racist experimentation on communities of color by white doctors in the United States. But if the recruitment process isn't improved, the vaccines could end up overlooking key health disparities among different racial demographics in the United States. Joining me now to talk about this is Dr. Chris Purnell, public health physician at the University Hospital in Newark, New Jersey. Dr. Purnell, thanks for being with me.
Good to be here.
Also with me is Dr. Hella Borno, assistant professor of medicine at UCSF. Dr. Borno, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Purnell, we'll start with you. Where do we stand so far in the process of developing a vaccine for COVID-19?
So right now, we're in the midst of phase three clinical trials across several vaccine candidates. We're looking in one in particular to enroll up to 30,000. That enrollment is actually happening at a fast pace. But as you just articulated, the concern is whether or not that enrollment will be diverse enough. There's a lot of pressure right now to get an effective vaccine candidate to market. But alongside that pressure, there is skepticism that has been with us for years, but which I think has been heightened.
I want to talk a lot about that skepticism in just a minute. Dr. Borno, there is an underrepresentation of people of color in COVID-19 vaccine trials. You have studied this, particularly among Black participants. What did you find?
So I was examining the representation or the types of patients that were enrolling in COVID-19 treatment clinical trials. I really took an early look at that data to try to observe if the patients enrolling in these trials were reflective of the patients that were being disproportionately affected by the disease. And what I observed with these early studies were that underrepresented Black patients across all the studies that were published to date, and they were underrepresented relative to the burden of disease of the affected population in the cities in which these studies took place. I found that to be a very sobering conclusion, and it was an early look that I think spurred even heavier push for the scientific discovery to really recruit patients who are reflective of the patients being disproportionately burdened by the disease.
Dr. Purnell, to that point, you decided to participate in a trial yourself. And why did you make that decision?
You know, it was a very personal decision, but it was my way to help honor my father's legacy and to help my sister in this fight, right? I lost my father to this pandemic. When we say this pandemic has been devastating, and when we say that it has disproportionately burdened Black and brown communities, I use my life as an example. I lost my father to the pandemic. My sister, who's a breast cancer survivor, is struggling to recover. She's what's known as a long hauler. And if you step back from that and you think about it, seeing that type of devastation and that being overlaid on this centuries-long skepticism that Black and brown communities have about, you know, the academic medical establishment, about clinical research, it drives and compels you to make sure we're articulating the story right and to make sure we're offering people the opportunity to be a part of the solution-building process. And so that was what motivated me. That gave me my fire in the belly. I needed to live my accountability. I couldn't go into the community and talk about clinical research and not just pushing a vaccine in particular, but just to make sure community is aware, informed, and engaged. And I felt honoring my dad's legacy and me walking the talk and living out my accountability that's something I needed to do.
First, Dr. Purnell, I want to express my condolences for your father's passing from COVID-19. And I want to ask you what the experience is like to be part of a trial, because I think, and we'll talk a lot about the skepticism in just a moment that communities of color have towards the American medical establishment in particular. But for those who might be thinking about this or considering it, what is it like to participate in a trial like this?
Right. So informed consent is sacred, right? It's something I talk about a lot in community, and I talk about self-efficacy, the ability to make an informed choice or decision. So I got lots of information. I personally have been following the developments around the pandemic, following the developments around the vaccine trials. And so when I considered enrolling, you have to go through a screening process. And as part of that screening process, you're given paperwork to read over, to ask questions, to make sure you understand clearly the risks versus benefits. It's emphasized that this is voluntary. It's not mandatory, that you can withdraw your participation at any time with no negative repercussions. You're given a sense of awareness of how long the process will take, that you'll be followed for approximately 2 years. You're educated around what likely side effects you could experience and what to do in the event that you do experience any of those side effects. There's so many checks and balances in the process to make sure you clearly understand what you're choosing to do, and to make sure you recognize and understand that if any point that this decision is no longer accurate and you want to remove yourself from the process, you're more than willing to do that. They check in with you daily, do symptoms check. I have to enter information into an app that's on my phone. So there's a lot of vigilance through the process, and I actually feel like there's a companion through the process talking me through each step.
Dr. Borno, we've even heard from the chief executive officer at Pfizer, who has made an appeal for more people of color to participate in these trials. But how, Dr. Borno, is that going to actually happen? You need to sort of entice and explain to communities of color that are already being ravaged by what many people are calling a pandemic within a pandemic. It's not just coronavirus, it's underlying health problems, it's people who are dying at disproportionate rates. I mean, there's so many things that are affecting particularly poor communities of color, that I don't see how we increase the participation of people of color in these medical trials.
Well, fears of experimentation and hereditary mistrust are certainly real, and they absolutely need to be acknowledged. However, I don't think that, you know, investigators can say, you know, it's because the participants that we want to have enroll in studies just don't trust us and place the blame only on trust. It takes work. You know, researchers and the science community has to do the work to help earn the trust. And that takes engagement in the communities in which we hope to have participate in clinical research. It takes the development of high quality health information and information about the science that is being conducted in plain language that can be accessible to everyone. So it takes a lot of work. And I think that if we just say it's about trust, and of communities lacking trust, then it blames the communities. But it's not only communities lacking trust, but it's the scientific community that needs to do the work to earn the trust. And that work is hard, but it is important. And the communities that we hope to have enroll in trials deserve that we make that effort in order for them to feel assured that as they go through the scientific process, that they are looked after, that it is rigorous, and that it ensures their safety.
I'd like to end the segment by asking both of you to sort of help us understand what happens, or what could happen. There is a race for a vaccine. There are political reasons for that, but there are also just people want to live right now. We are facing something that's unprecedented. What could the outcome be if we do not recruit enough people of color for these vaccine trials, considering that these vaccines are being developed at a rate that I think is unprecedented? There's an enormous amount of pressure for pharmaceutical companies to find the quote-unquote silver bullet here. But will they be able to do that in time? And if they can't recruit enough communities of color to participate, what are the long-term effects of that? Dr. Purnell.
If we can't recruit enough Black and Browns to be a part of the vaccine trial and just clinical research in general, we just perpetuate the inequity, right? We perpetuate the inequity that leads to healthcare disparities that we continue to see that are plagued plagued by, these communities are plagued by, and that will only deepen the mistrust. And when we talk about a lack of trust, we don't end there. We just center there, because also accompanying a lack of trust is a lack of community empowerment. So if we don't work on those two things in parallel, and then we get a vaccine that hasn't been thoroughly evaluated in a diverse population, how do we say convincingly, or how can we say that this is effective across the entire population? I think we're going to have an uphill battle around the uptake of the vaccine, right? And a part of that has to happen with us taking several steps back, right? When I say empowerment, we have to build relationships with these communities, not just when we want them to participate in particular transactions like clinical research, but we must do community participatory action, right? We must ask community, what are your priorities? What would you like to see happen? All of that's going to be necessary for there to be effective participation across Black and Brown communities, and then effective uptake of the vaccine. So that's what I'm remaining vigilant about. That's just a conversation we had in community last night. So that's just being very real to what we face right now.
Dr. Borno.
The clinical studies that are being conducted are trying to develop the science to prove that these vaccines are safe and these vaccines are effective. But if we observe later on that they're only safe and effective in certain populations, just imagine that scenario. Imagine if certain communities are left vulnerable to the infection or are experiencing considerable toxicity or harm from the vaccine. That would be truly devastating, and I think would certainly create even a worsening chasm in our broken healthcare system. So I think it is an imperative that these studies focus on recruitment of populations that would most benefit from the availability of this vaccine.
Dr. Hella Borno is an assistant professor of medicine at UCSF, and Dr. Chris Purnell is a public health physician at University Hospital in Newark, New Jersey. Thanks to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE, or you can reach us on Twitter at The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.